And tonight we're looking at the mind of a serial killer, the story of John Wayne Gacy with our two special guests, the book John Wayne Gacy, Defending a Monster. And we're with Sam Amarante and Danny Broderick as we talk about their work on John Wayne Gacy. When the prosecution was fighting you over the insanity plea, and you know everybody decided we're going to try this guy this way, what happened? I mean, how were you able to defend that?
Here, before I answer that, George, before I forget to tell you, you know, we're both really honored to be on your show. Oh. We've been on a lot of local shows, TV and radio this week.
Yeah.
And I had so many people coming up to me the last few days, a couple days, saying, hey, I heard you're going to be on Coast to Coast. Or you're going to be on George Norrie. We love that guy. We love that show. I had a couple of truckers, a few police officers, nurses. I mean, different out of people I know, you know, came out of nowhere. So I heard you're going to be on that show. They love it. So anyway, you know, thanks for having us.
Well, we love Chicago. And,
yeah, thanks, Jeff.
It's a great story. But I mean, how do you defend something like that once you realize your biggest plea, and that's insanity, is thrown out the window?
All right, well, our only plea, and it really wasn't thrown out the window. I mean, that was our only plea, and our theory of the case was to, because we knew if Gacy were released, if he was found not guilty, completely not guilty, which, I mean, there was very little hope of that anyway, since he confessed to the police. He told them everything that he told
me. Okay.
And there was no real defense for reasonable doubt to go in there. I mean, we had some pretrial motions trying to throw evidence out, which Judge Garippo masterfully handled. If this was a single, double, or triple murder, the cases, the evidence might have gone out. But in that case, we knew it wasn't going to go out. And Garippo, Judge Garippo, made a great record on that. But as far as defenses, insanity in that case, because of his confessions, because of the circumstances, because of the way he was our only defense.
Only way out. Yeah.
Yeah, many lawyers will tell you, you know, insanity is a defense of last resort. It was our only defense there. And what we had to do is just introduce the issue by way of psychiatric and lay testimony that Gacy was suffering from a mental illness, and as a result of that mental illness, again, he could not appreciate the criminality of his act or conform his conduct to the requirements of law. And we did create that issue, not only through the doctors who testified for us, and we had some of the best in the country. We had Dr. Lawrence Zellick Friedman from the University of Chicago. We had Dr. Tobias Broker from the Menninger Foundation. We had Dr. Helen Morrison, who had studied serial killers her entire existence. We had Dr. Richard Rappaport. We had a host of psychologists. And more importantly than that, we introduced evidence from lay witnesses who worked with Gacy, who knew him, who partied with him, who were almost his victims, who were his victims but weren't killed. And they testified to the jury under oath that Gacy was insane, that Gacy was mentally ill. We had one kid in particular who was working for him, and Gacy really got along with and liked him. He was working in his garage, Gacy's garage, one day, and they were laughing, having fun. All of a sudden, Gacy attacked him with a hammer. He got a look on his eye. He started growling, and he started hitting him with a hammer. And the guy's screaming, John, what are you doing? What are you doing? He's writhing in pain. And then just a few seconds later, Gacy stopped hitting him and says, geez, I don't know what came over me. I'm sorry.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, you know, there's evidence of that happened on several occasions with people that he considered his friends.
Yeah, and then he just wouldn't do it. And another kid he picked up, a kid who wrote a book, Jeff Rignall, he was one of our witnesses. And Gacy picked him up. Gacy pretended he was a police officer, put him in the car. The kid was hanging around Buckhouse Square, which was called Buckhouse Square in Chicago, where people used to give speeches and things like that. And but it was a hangout for homosexuals, male prostitutes, hustlers, things of that nature. And Gacy picked this kid up, put him in the car, took him back to his place, and they were laughing and talking. And he said Gacy turned on him. He went from this nice guy, like a Jekyll guy, and immediately turned into this monster and started attacking him and tried, you know, he tried doing the rope trick on him and everything else, and the kid got away. And but he said Gacy just turned like that.
Well, these people, though, like John Wayne Gacy, the Ted Bundys, the Jeffrey Dahmers, those, how many are out there? How many John Wayne Gacy's, Sam and Danny, are out there now, and we have no idea where they are?
You're absolutely correct, George, and it's the scariest part of the Gacy case. Gacy, a guy like Gacy could be listening to us right now, could have served on the D.C. jury, could be out there being good neighbor, you know, a good neighbor to somebody, and you don't know it. And that's one of the things we wanted to do in that case, and that is to convince the jury, instead of putting him to death, to study him.
Study him.
To find out what made him do those things so we could prevent it, so we could recognize those kind of traits in other people, and we still can't.
Now, a doctor's got his brain, right?
Helen Morrison, yeah.
Yeah, Dr. Helen Morrison took his brain after he was put to death and actually dissected it. And I've talked to Helen about it, who's an absolutely wonderful doctor, wonderful person. And she wasn't able to find anything physiologically wrong with his brain. And we did all kind of alcohol-induced EEGs and just different looking for spikes and things like that from drug-induced EEGs. And at the time, with, you know, the medical knowledge available to us, we couldn't find anything wrong physically with his brain. But his brain, and like Danny so aptly put in our book, was broken. And it was broken probably or maybe from birth, or maybe it broke somewhere along the line. But the man's brain, his mind, was broken.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, did he get good grades in school?
Not really.
No.
He would have, nowadays, you know, and then they didn't have it, but nowadays he would have probably been considered a special ed child. He was a bright kid. He was, like I said, he had probably 160 IQ.
Yeah.
But he never really excelled in school. But he wasn't a failure in school either. He was a mediocre student. No real problems in school with teachers. I mean, he was a likable kid. He was a likable kid who just wanted to have friends.
Might he have killed more than 33?
34.
34.
He told me specifically about 34. He said that 5 were in the Des Plaines River. Only 4 bodies were recovered there. And we always wondered what happened with the other body. He was absolutely adamant about a 5th body in the Des Plaines River. And we didn't know if it got taken down river by a barge or something else happened or just never was found, but they never found a 5th body. However, just a couple of days ago after the story came out, I got a call from a retired Cook County sheriff who said that in around 76 or so, a family he knew lost a child who was found in the Des Plaines River, 16-year-old, in around 76. So that very well may be...
That might have been the one.
The 34th victim. But there's a lot of speculation that there were more, that he did these things in other parts of the country, in other parts of Chicago. Everything happened in that house of horrors. Everything happened in that house. And he put most of the bodies in that house. And when he ran out of room, he went to the Des Plaines River. And he actually was planning to build a second story in his house because he didn't want to keep going to the Des Plaines River. If he killed somebody else, he wanted to make sure he could bury them right in their house between the first and second floor.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. He had one under his dining room table. He had one under the patio, one in the garage.
Now, would he kill when he was in his married days, or was that later?
No, he was married. He was married. His mom was living with him. His wife was living there at the time. And they didn't know what was going on.
I mean,
like his father, he would spend a lot of time out in the garage, and his wife would, you know, he would be out there puttering around like many men do, and she wouldn't question what he was doing out there.
Well, it's like that BK killer. People thought he was good with his church and everything else, and off he goes.
Yeah, all these guys are charming. Bundy was a very charming guy, you know, and they're a totally different kind of breed of their own. There's really no place for them in the psychiatric, the diagnostic manual. They're kind of a breed of their own, these serial killers.
Had he been found guilty by reason of insanity, what would have happened to him?
Well, first of all, we have teasing Danny tonight. We had a plan. I said, this could have been the real end of the book. They had my trial partner at the time, and I said, if he's found not guilty, we're going to take one of those ropes on the counsel table and put it around his neck and strangle him, and then we'll claim insanity. But what have happened to him, what we really wanted to happen, was that he'd be placed in a structured environment in a mental institution where he would be studied, where he would be able to talk to people, and different doctors would be talking to him and maybe pick up some signs of what that we could notice in somebody else. But if he ever were let go, he would have to have been there forever anyway, because if he were let out of there, he would have done it again.
Yeah,
there's no doubt in my mind. Gacy was incurable.
But he had a special window of the type of young men and boys that he went after. He never went after older guys or little kids.
Right, or girls.
Or girls. The type of boys that he liked. The kind of actually boy that he described to his wife when they were sitting in that bar that day. He actually liked, ironically enough, they looked a little like one of the prosecutors, Terry Sullivan.
Yeah.
And Gacy used to like Sullivan. He always had his eye on Sullivan.
Oh, my God. I wonder why.
I teased Terry, who wrote Killer Clown, and I teased Terry to this day about
it. Did Gacy ever, at any point, both of you, you specifically, Sam, did he ever freak you out or scare you just by being around?
Physically, no. He never scared me. And I'm not easily scared. And so physically, in that way, in a fear way, he never scared me. What scared me was that first night when, and this was one of the things that scared me, when I heard this horrible, I was living with this, almost like he cast these sins upon me. I felt like I had been molested, I had been raped, or so I felt dirty, and all these secrets that I had to keep now. As a lawyer, you have to keep these secrets.
Well, and I wanted to ask you that after he told you this, what did you do, go home?
Well, after he left, he got up in the night, he went through this, told me all this stuff, then he fell asleep, and then when he woke up, he was like growling, he had a guttural growling, and his eyes were fluttering back, and he was walking toward me like the Frankenstein monster.
Oh.
I grabbed a baseball bat, and I'm yelling at him, and he was like sleepwalking right toward me, and he wasn't paying attention to me. He followed me right out in the hallway, right in the vision of the police officers that were out there.
Right.
They were looking with their eyes wide open, what the heck's going on? Got out there, he stopped, I pushed him down with the bat, and he sat in the chair, and he fell back asleep again. And then when he got up in the morning, he didn't, like nothing happened. Like he didn't tell us anything.
Didn't even know where he was. Jeez.
He had to do things. And I went home. He took off. The police chased him. He delivered a bag of marijuana to some kid right in front of the police to answer your question whether he wanted to get caught. And he looked at them and smiled, and he took off again. And in the meantime, I went home and took a shower. And, George, I felt like that. That scene in Psycho?
Oh, yeah.
There's a bathroom scene.
Yeah, like the knife's coming through.
I'm taking a shower, and I felt like that. Like I'm in the shower, and somebody's going to come through with that knife and start stabbing.
Absolutely. You're taking a shower with your eyes open.
Oh, right? And that was when the kind of fear struck me. And of course, ethical fear as a lawyer. I knew where bodies were. He didn't tell me he was going to commit a crime, but he said if he did, he was going to bury more. And there's a fine line. If we know a crime is going to be committed as officers of the court, that's not a secret. We have to disclose that. But he didn't tell me he was going to commit another crime. And that was a scary thing to me.
Yeah.
And the only other thing that scared me in the course of the trial, again, I'm a pretty volatile Italian father myself, okay? And I have kids. And if somebody did something to my kid, I'm going to go get him.
You're going to get him.
As a man, I'm going to go get him.
You're going to do it.
And what scared me during the trial, and I got a zillion threats from people. But it wasn't the threats that bothered me. That stuff never bothered me as a lawyer, as a judge, in any other way. What bothered me was that there's some father out there among all those parents who thought just like I did. And they were going to try to get Gacy and shoot Gacy, and I was going to be in the way. That's the only other kind of fear I ever had. Otherwise, just never, it was doing my job.
You've got a picture of him standing next to First Lady, then at the time, Rosalynn Carter.
Yeah.
How did he pull that off?
Danny?
He was actually checked out in those days. The checking process wasn't quite what it is today. John Wayne Gacy was he ran the Polish Day Parade in the city of Chicago. We're trying to describe how...
And that's a huge parade.
Huge. The only one that's bigger is the St. Patrick's Day Parade.
Right.
So had he been Irish... He would have ran the St. Patrick's Day Parade. This guy was known by the mayor. He was known by the governor. He was known by, police officers and people all around town. He would have these block parties once a year, and 400 people would show up. And his house was the focal point of the party, but it would then go up and down the block. But people would be in and out of his house.
And he's barbecuing, no doubt, doing
exactly
everything.
Exactly that. And they were theme parties so that they'd be dressed up one year as revolutionaries, and then the next year it'd be something else. So the point I'm trying to make is that this guy, nobody suspected him. Nobody suspected.
Yeah, you know, you just trusted him. He's the kind of guy everybody just trusted, and he was able to get in those positions like that. And that's the scariest part about it. That's what I'm telling you, George. It's scary because you wouldn't be able to pick it out. You wouldn't be able to pick him out of a crowd that this guy's a killer. He didn't look like a killer. Again, he wasn't that big, mean, scary-looking guy that Dennehy played. He was just a con man. He was not only the most prolific serial killer of all time, he was the most prolific con man.
Yeah.
Master manipulator of all time.
Well, that's where that IQ came in.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. See, he was a psychotic, neurotic, genius psychopath. And very much like the character in, not as scary a character, but the character that Ed Gein was based on in that movie Silence of the Lambs.
Ed Gein.
Very, very cunning, very manipulative, but not scary, in a happy sort of way.
Yeah, and not as sophisticated, I wouldn't say.
Right, in a happy sort of way. Yeah. You know, like he would kill his victims, he'd play this clown part, and he would do this handcuff trick, and he'd put handcuffs on himself, and then he would take the handcuffs off and get out of them, and he'd say, that's a magic trick. And the kids would say, how can you do it? He said, well, you try it. He'd put the handcuffs on them, and they'd be laughing and joking, and they'd try to get out of the handcuffs, and they couldn't do it. And they'd say, well, what's the trick, John? And he would take the key out of his pocket or in his hand. He would hold it up and say, here's the trick. I had the key. You're dumb and stupid.
And then he'd go nuts.
And then he would go nuts, and then he'd say, here, try to get out of this. I got another trick for you. And he put a rope around their neck, and he would twist the rope with a hammer handle, and he'd say, now try to get out of this. And he would talk to them, not always go nuts, but sometimes very calmly, talk to them and twist the rope. He killed three guys, all bigger than him, simultaneously with his rope trick. Put them all in the same grave.
Was it the power of killing people that he enjoyed?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if he enjoyed it. I think he really felt, and after talking to the doctors for so long, he really felt like he was killing himself over and over again, projecting out.
That's what the state argued, and, you know, there certainly is room for that argument. But there was also testimony that he was killing himself. I was always of the opinion that the more he liked you, If he was getting on with a person that he had picked up...
The
more emotionally close he got, the more it seemed to him that that meant that he was becoming homosexual, or he was going to have to admit that he was homosexual. And he couldn't do that.
Which he never wanted to admit. He would always say he was bisexual.
This guy admitted the most heinous crimes known to man. He's one of the most prolific serial killers of all time, and he confessed to all those crimes. But he went to his grave never admitting that he was homosexual.
Well, but why? What was it? And we're coming up to the break here, so I don't know if we'll have time for this, Sam and Danny, but why did he finally decide to confess? Why? How long could he have kept the ruse going?
Well, I think, you know, like you said in the beginning of the show, I think he really wanted to get caught. I think he broke the mold with his last victim.
Something happened.
And he really wanted it to stop. He was saying, stop me before I kill again.
Plus, he was cornered. It was clear to him, I think, at that time.
He would have been arrested.
Over. Yeah, it was over.
Yeah. It was over.
All right, let's talk more about your life as lawyers. There's some other cases that are out there that I'm just curious to get your opinions on as lawyers. And then later on tonight, we'll take phone calls with both of you, with our two guests, as we talk about their work. John Wayne Gacy, defending a monster, and a monster indeed he was. Their website, by the way, is all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It's also called defendingamonster.com. I'm George Norrie, and we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we've been talking about the mind of the serial killer, John Wayne Gacy, tonight on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls on this subject. When we come right back on Coast to Coast AM, we'll talk a little bit more about the eyes of an attorney through some of these cases that you're familiar with when we come right back. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Judge Sam Amaranti and Danny Broderick, their book, John Wayne Gacy. Sam, let me ask you this about the case that, of course, all America knows about, the Casey Anthony case, with its huge inconsistencies. Give me, as a trial attorney, give me an overview from your perspective about that entire case.
Well, actually, I think as a trial attorney, as a retired judge, I sat on the bench for a long time.
Yeah.
I think the jury I don't know everything about the case, but from what I read and from what I saw, I think the jury reached the proper decision in that case. As a individual person, I mean, I was one of those people on the computer, you know, putting, you know, lights on for Kaylee, you know, and lighting lights and everything, because I think it was a very sad case. I think she might have committed the act. The one thing I didn't understand about the whole thing was, you know, how a mom, you know, I have a little girl, you know, at my age, I have a little 5-year-old daughter. And, you know, if she's not in my sight for 30 seconds, I start panicking.
Right.
You know, where is she? You know, 31 days ago, but I mean, it was a real problem I had with that case, that how could a mother do that? You know, but I did see it plenty. You know, I see it plenty in my profession, too, you know, with parents with neglect. But because a parent is neglectful or parting, does that make her a murderer? And the evidence simply wasn't there. And, you know, that's really, and the defense lawyer in that case did a good job. He put the state to their burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and the prosecutor simply did not have the evidence. And you cannot convict somebody of murder without the evidence. And I think the jury, you know, I'm sure a lot of people out there get angry for me to say it, but they were angry with the jury. But that jury is sworn, just like lawyers are, to uphold the Constitution. The jury is sworn before they deliberate and before they listen to the evidence, to follow the law, to listen to the facts, and make the determination based upon what they see and hear in court. And they obviously felt that the state came short of proving the defendant, Casey Anthony, guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. That's what
in spite of all the inconsistencies. Danny, what do you think?
I predicted that she would be found not guilty when they were coming back. I don't believe that they had the evidence. You have inconsistencies. You have emotional responses to this sort of thing. But the one thing that did come out, that didn't get covered quite as much as the trial did, after the trial, it came out that the computer scientist, I think his name was Bradley, who originally ran the program that discovered that her computer searched chloroform 64 times.
That was wrong.
Yeah, he admitted that he was wrong. Now, and the determination was that it searched it once. Well, that changes all the evidence in the case. It changes the theory of the case that she found out about chloroform, and then she systematically used chloroform to kill her baby. I have to be honest with you, and again, I didn't sit on the jury, and I certainly didn't follow the case every single day, but to hear the evidence that was there, it is as plausible to believe that the baby drowned. Now, her actions afterwards were either those of a very irresponsible girl or a crazy girl.
Right. Or she did it. Or she did it.
We can't guess. Cannot guess that. Because if she didn't do it, why should she be?
I mean, my God, I've got 3 children, and when they were little babies, I was paranoid of them in swimming pools. Paranoid. Yeah. I mean, I pulled my little. We were at a party once, and the owner of the house had a built-in pool, and I would watch my son religiously. I turned my head away for 20 seconds. I look back, and he's floating at the bottom of the pool in the 3-foot section.
Oh, wow.
And I mean, I go nuts. I reach down, I pull him up, and he's like floating, you know, on his back on the bottom. I pull him up, and he had apparently fallen off the step, and down he went. But I got to tell you, God forbid, had anything happened to him, I wouldn't have concocted stories about it.
No,
absolutely. Absolutely on the same page. I feel the same way.
I have a dear friend whose sister had that happen to her, and she was never the same again. She actually lost the daughter in a pool. And, you know, just to think of that, I have 2 sons. They're older now, but when they were kids.
It's mind-boggling, but, you know, there's plenty of parents out there. When I was a judge, I sat in a child abuse and neglect for a while, and, in the city of Chicago, and it was like there was a whole subculture of the abuse and the neglect that went on, and people wouldn't care about their kids. And, you know, even Dr. Stein in the Gacy case, I mean, there were still to this day, there's a handful of victims who haven't been identified. And Dr. Stein said, unfortunately, some of these kids aren't even runaways or throwaways. And that's frightening to think, but there are parents out there who think like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe Casey Anthony's one of those parents, but that doesn't make her a murderer.
Yeah. At the end of the Gacy trial, there were still 11 unidentified victims, and they used whatever technology they had at the time, and that case reached every corner of this country and others. And still, 22 people, 11 sets of parents, either looked at the screen and, you know, there had to be some other parents out there that were going, I wonder if Johnny, you know, could be one.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they didn't come forward.
And as parents, you wonder why God, you know, allows people like this to have children. You know, there's so many people out there who want to have children, who can't have children, who adopt children, who use in vitro fertilization and so forth. And there's people out there who have children like that, and then they don't care about them. I mean, they dump them in dumpsters. They throw them away. They go out and play wherever they want to play, and the parents are drunk and drugged up somewhere. I mean, we hate to admit that, but it's a fact. There are parents like that. And obviously, Casey Anthony was one of those kind of parents. But again, we're talking about a murder case. And unless, in any kind of criminal case, unless there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, and unless that presumption of innocence can be overcome by that proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that person needs to go free because that person just might be innocent.
Yeah. I mean, but there's obviously something wrong with her. I mean, you look after the trial, she's caught on video shopping, looking for clothes.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. I mean, I'd be in deep mourning. I'd never be the same myself.
Another person with a broken brain, clearly.
I agree 100%
yeah.
with you. And I hated the fact that she was acquitted as a man, as a person, as a dad. As a lawyer, though, and as a retired judge, I have to tell you, looking at the evidence, I agree with Danny. It simply was not there, and a person cannot be convicted.
Was the prosecution that bad they couldn't get a conviction?
I don't know if they were bad. They simply didn't have the evidence. It falls short. And that's another answer to your question. You know, how does defense, you know, people would ask, how do you sleep with yourself? You know, if a guilty person goes free or murder goes free, I could sleep like a baby if I do my job. If the prosecutor doesn't do their job, and they're elected by the people to do their job, if they don't do it, they're the ones that should lose sleep.
Yeah.
Because they have to get enough evidence to convict that person. Honestly, they can't concoct evidence, which happens sometimes. They have to be honest about it and ethical about it, but they have to try their best to get enough evidence to convict. And if they don't do it and the person's truly guilty, then they're the ones who should lose sleep.
Well, and before the defense brought the possible drowning as a possibility, do you think they tried to convince her to cop a plea?
I'm sure there were pretrial negotiations, but a lot of times in high-profile cases like that, I can't say I'm sure because there might not have been. The prosecution might have just said, no, we're going to go all the way on this case, and the defense may have said that, too. And, again, I wasn't privy to that, so
yeah.
Something you'd probably have to ask.
Yeah, a lot of times as a defense attorney, if there's no offer or if the offer is, you know, she's going to jail for the rest of the life of her life, that's the best will offer, you can't take an offer like that, especially, you know, if you feel that you can win the case.
Right. And who makes the offer, by the way? Does the prosecution have to make the offer first, or can the defense go in and say, hey, let's cut a deal here?
Sort of a give and take. Sometimes the defense initiates it. Many times the prosecutor does. I personally do not, as the prosecutors who do know me, no, I do not like to initiate those kind of conferences. I go in there to fight and fight to win, and I negotiate from strength. If I go in there to prepare and I fight to win and I'm going to attack their case, then generally they would come to me with an offer and say, let's try to resolve this case like this. And then I'll have clients sometimes who insist they're innocent, and then they'll want to take a cop a plea because they might be afraid of going to jail. If we lose, they might be afraid of going to jail, so they want to plead guilty. I won't let somebody plead guilty if they tell me they're innocent. And no matter how the odds are stacked against them, because if they're truly innocent and I do my job, I should win the case.
So when they killed John Wayne Gacy by lethal injection, what did it feel like for you, Sam, after the fact? And were you there during that?
No, I could have been. I refused to go. I really didn't want to go. He was still my client. I was probably the only person in the world at that point. Me and my trial partner, probably the only two people in the world who felt something for him and felt that, you know, he was our client. And to us, to the rest of the world, George, he was a monster.
Yeah.
To us, he was our client.
He was your client.
And our client is a human being. And I just don't want to see him, you know, be.
Were there any glimpses of his personality that you liked when you were with him?
Once I started representing him, no.
No.
Oh, no. That was I didn't like, you don't have to like your client. I don't like a lot of clients, but that's not, you know.
That's not your job. It's not your job to like him.
My job is to defend him, and as far as liking him, no, there's nothing I liked about him. He was a con man, a manipulator, and the guy killed 34 kids.
I'm sure he would have been killed in prison had he been convicted, and went into jail that way. Was he like sequestered, or was he in the prison population? Because he should have been killed.
Yeah, well, because he was on death row for most of the time, he was isolated.
What I thought.
But actually, one time when he did get out, he was doing some work around the cell. He did get stabbed by another killer, a guy named Henry Brisbane, stabbed him. And there was speculation as to whether it was on purpose or intentional, but nobody really knew. But yeah, you're right. I mean, guys like that, I think it happened to Dahmer, didn't they? Dahmer
got killed that way. Yeah. They go right after them.
There's that code. There's still that prison code in there. And
priests who are convicted, the same thing happens to them in prison.
Yeah, don't screw with kids. You can rob a bank, you can kill because you're in a gang.
Yep.
Don't mess with kids.
Yep. You hurt a kid, the prison population, schools itself, they really do. What lessons did both of you learn with the John Wayne Gacy case?
Boy, as far as liking him, he did show good parts. Like, you would talk about a child with, say, cancer who was dying, and John would read about it in the paper and bawl like a baby, totally start crying and be upset because the kid was dying. And then he would talk about his own victims like they didn't even exist, like they were garbage to be thrown out on the curb. I mean, there was no consciousness of guilt, no remorse, no nothing. But yet somebody he didn't know in a faraway land who might be dying of starvation, he would cry like a baby. It's called inappropriate affect. It's one of the cornerstones of psychosis. As far as what I learned, I certainly learned a lot about psychology. I learned a lot about practicing law. I learned a lot about the media. But I think most importantly, as a lawyer, later on became a judge, I think I learned compassion for people. I certainly became a very, very overprotective parent. My two sons still curse me to this day because I was so overprotective.
I don't blame you.
Dad. And I'm still that way. I'm that way to kids in general. That's why I wrote that iSearch law back in 1984, the Missing Child Act of 1984. Because I asked the jury to do something. I felt like I should do something as a human being.
Well, time's critical.
I learned a lot. I learned a lot about life, and I think I learned to handle myself on the bench in a lot better way. And I really cared about kids and young people who came in front of me. They used to call me the hugging judge because they used to make kids hug their parents and things like that. And I took a lot of that way with me from the Gacy case. And I think it made me a better lawyer. It made me a better judge. And I think it made me a better person. So that silver lining behind that horrible, horrible dark cloud.
Well, I bet you two have seen all kinds in your profession, haven't you?
Oh, we have.
Absolutely.
Okay. And in Gacy's case, the clown outfit, why did he do that?
He was actually a clown. I mean, he was a clown like any other clown. You know, it's actually Gacy that gave clowns a bad name.
I hate clowns because of him and Stephen King.
Right. Well, that's what happened. They sort of turned the image of a clown. When I was a kid, I'm 60 years old. When I was a kid, clowns were fun, and you'd have them at a birthday party or something like that. You see them at the circus. They weren't considered scary, and still to this day, they still are at the circus, and they still come to birthday parties. That's what Gacy was. He was a registered clown.
Well, what's interesting about Gacy, too, is when he learned how to put his makeup on, most clowns will do the rounded edges around your lips and things like that. He would do this jagged-looking, spiky look, which would scare the heck out of people, wouldn't it?
Well, I think that might be an insight into his personality. I don't think he thought he was scaring people. And frankly, he did that for a long time. And he went around little kids And I don't think it was in an effort to try to befriend
scare
little
them.
Kids.
No, it was just...
He was actually...
It was in his subconscious.
Yeah, George, when he was a clown, he was the good Gacy.
Yeah.
And he was the good Gacy. He was the Jekyll part of the personality. And he really wasn't there to hurt kids. He was there to help kids and make kids laugh. And that was a dichotomy of him. We actually... One time he had said, and I had him recorded saying it, that Robbie Peace, his last victim, was a good kid. He said he was a good kid, and he was this. He said, I think he said something like he might have been a little greedy or something, which kind of, you know, triggered Gacy into what he did. He said because he was a good kid, but then he was a little greedy. And then, in a chilling way, Gacy says, and then he met the other John Gacy.
Yeah.
And in the way he says it, it was just chilling because that was the evil guy. But when he was good, you know, people speculate, oh, he's a clown, and, he was dealing with kids. When he was with those kids at children's hospitals and things like that, and he was helping them, he was the good John Gacy then. And he wasn't going to hurt anybody when he was a clown.
I thought originally during the case that, when I was thinking about this, that the fact that he was in a clown outfit, that he wanted to use that to get kids, he never did he?
No,
not one time. That was the good Gacy. I tell you, there was that. You have to consider if the book Jekyll and Hyde. When he was good, he was good. There wasn't evil about him when he was good. But when he turned bad, and he would turn quickly... He was the worst of evil.
Could police have caught him much earlier?
Yes, they could have. And, if it was nowadays, they would have. And, we talk about the homosexual things with Gacy. Number of young kids went in and complained about Gacy. The ones who testified at trial for attacking him, wanting to file complaints about him. But Gacy was a clout guy. He was a precinct captain. He was a big man in the community. He was a blowhard, small-time politician. And his complainants were basically gay kids. And at the time, the police are a lot different than they are today in a lot of ways. They weren't as well-educated and more macho. And these gay kids would come in and...
And they thought they were ganging up on him or something?
No, they would just say, they wouldn't believe him. They'd say, get out of here, you're a little queer or something like that. We don't want to listen to you. This guy, come on, this guy wouldn't do that. He's a, he's got a lot of credibility. What credibility do you have?
He's one of us.
Queer, he's one of us.
They could have stopped
so nobody listened
a to him. Number now, of murders.
Now it would be different because the police department personnel are better trained and they would listen to those kind of complaints and they would investigate Gacy, where then they didn't investigate him. And again, that's one of the things the iSearch law was. It forced the police department's hands to investigate those kind of missing child cases much quicker than they did.
Was he scared of dying when they injected him, or
no.
Was he willing to go?
No. I don't think he was willing to go, and I don't think he was scared to go. I don't think he thought he was going to go.
Yeah.
Gacy, again, such a con man, and he was able to put himself into a self-trance, where his eyes would roll back and the whites of his eyes would show and he'd sort of tremble a little bit.
Yeah.
And that's what he did in his execution. And I really believe he didn't think he was going to die. And he really convinced himself that he was innocent at that time, too.
Yeah, by that time, he had repudiated everything that Sam did. And he had taken the position, in spite of all his confessions and all of the, the time spent telling police officer after police officer every element of the crime. By 14 years later, he was going to his death saying he never did it.
Jeez, we're going to come back and take final phone calls with both of you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.